Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, I'm speaking with Silicon Valley investor and author Roger McNamee. Roger was an early investor in Facebook and a former mentor to CEO Mark Zuckerberg. He helped to recruit now COO Sheryl Sandberg to the company in 2008. A self-proclaimed tech optimist, Roger McNamee has become an unlikely critic of Facebook and other internet platforms, including Google and Amazon. In his book released in February, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, Roger McNamee highlights the reasons for his alarm, writing that Facebook and other platforms have undermined our trust, privacy, health, economy, and democracy through the development and promotion of addictive technology, technology that is easily manipulated by bad actors. In this hour, I'll discuss with Roger the dark side of social media and what we can do to protect our privacy, health, and democracy. Is last month's Federal Trade Commission settlement enough to regulate this tech giant? And if not, what still needs to be done? Roger McNamee has been an investor in Silicon Valley for over 35 years. He and the musician Bono co-founded Elevation Partners, a private equity investment fund focused on the intersection between technology and media. In his spare time, he's also a musician with the American rock band. Is it Moon Alice?
Moon Alice.
So I welcome Roger McNamee to
Joseph,
City Visions.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join in on our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So, Roger, we were talking just before the program started that this book came out in February. Lots has happened since then. Perhaps your thinking has evolved and expanded on this topic. But let's get to basics first. Let's talk about Facebook, perhaps as a case study to a larger conversation about how technology has invaded, intruded into our lives in ways that we did not know and in ways that you did not know. Tell us about your trajectory and how do you got to the epiphany you got to?
When I met Mark Zuckerberg in 2006, I had already spent half my life investing in technology companies. I'd been lucky enough to come to the Valley before the personal computer was really an industry, when Silicon Valley was primarily focused on space. It was a very different time. It was the convergence of the incredible optimism of the space program with the hippie values of Atari and Apple. And I fit in. I just completely loved it. When I met Mark, one of his colleagues said, my boss has a crisis and he needs to talk to somebody who's been around a long time. Now, keep in mind, at that point, Facebook had 9 million users. It didn't even have news feed yet. Mark had just turned 22 years old. And when I met him, he comes into my office. He looks just like Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, he's got the sandals, the skinny jeans, the gray T-shirt, the hoodie, you know, the courier bag. And it turns out that he gave me a chance to give him the context for why I took the meeting, because even though I couldn't use the product, it was only available to high school and college students, I was already convinced it was going to be the next big thing. I thought that his focus on requiring authenticated identity, because remember, it was only high school and college students. They had to have their school email address to get on. I thought that was the game changer that was going to prevent trolls from taking over and making the environment terrible. So it was going to let them be successful where MySpace and Friendster had eventually died. I was very excited to meet him. And when he gave me my chance to tell him what I was taking, I explained to him that if it hadn't already happened, somebody was going to attempt to buy Facebook. And I gave him a whole list of reasons of what was going to happen and all of which I described in the book. And the amazing thing was that was the reason he was coming to see me. And everything that I said to him was exactly, even the numbers, the companies, everything was exactly what was going on. So that became the foundation of a 3-year period of me being one of his mentors. And I really liked Mark. He was an incredibly appealing character at age 22. You know, really nerdy in the way that all the best Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are. And I liked him very, very much. Now, my relationship, though, with him was very limited. I was a business advisor. I was more than twice his age. And I was in no, you know, I had no interest in having like a social. So I missed big parts of Mark and things that would have given me signals much earlier than I got. The Mark I saw was very mature. Our conversations were almost entirely one-on-one, so I didn't have a lot of exposure to the rest of his team. And I really liked him. And I had a chance a year or two later for our firm to make a big investment. And that worked out really, really well. And in bringing in Cheryl, and then my job there was really done. So in 2009, I sort of moved out of being an insider into being just a fan in the bleachers, cheering him on. And things happened. There were signals that my original vision for Facebook, this very safe environment, this thing that offered real privacy protection, that was not actually core to their vision. That was just a convenient way to get the technology off the ground. And I didn't really get it until the beginning of 2016. I had just retired from the investment business. I left because the value system of Silicon Valley changed and I was no longer comfortable, you know, backing the best and brightest when those companies were Juul and Uber and Airbnb, companies who basically did things I couldn't support. And all of a sudden I noticed in the Democratic primary in January 2016 that there were things going on inside Facebook groups that were inauthentic, that they were growing and spreading really almost hate speech in ways that didn't strike me as real. And then 2 months later, Facebook expelled a corporation for using the ad tools to gather data on people who were interested in the Black Lives Matter civil rights group. And they were selling that data to police departments who would then harass the people. Now, Facebook did the right thing. They expelled them. But the damage had been done. And that was the first time I realized, oh my gosh, these tools can have a dark side. And it all came into focus in June of 2016 with Brexit. The United Kingdom voted on whether to leave the European Union. And that was the first time I realized that the same elements of persuasive technology that allow Facebook to be so engaging with people have this asymmetric element in the election where fear and outrage are the most effective way of communicating messages on Facebook. And in the context of a political spectrum that goes from left to right, people on the right, on average, are going to be easier to scare because they're less optimistic. And it's not a character flaw. It's just, it's about human psychology. And, you know, what happened in Brexit made me realize, oh, my God, the ad tools are going to harm democracy. And that's when I got really serious about figuring out what was going on. Eventually, in October, 9 days before the U.S. election, I sent a draft op-ed to Mark and Cheryl to warn them, to say, guys, I think there's something wrong here. Something wrong with the business model. Something wrong with the algorithms that allows bad actors to hurt innocent people, and you need to get on top of it.
So with all due respect, it took you like 10 years to figure this out?
Yeah.
Why do you think you were duped? Zucked?
No, duped. I mean, duped is the wrong term. Here's what I would tell you. It was a failure of analysis. I'm a professional investor, and there were signals, and some of them I picked up. But the nature of my relationship to Mark and to Cheryl was such that I assumed that their reaction to failure would be the same as my own, that they would learn from it and change their behavior. What I didn't really understand was that move fast and break things was not actually just a cute teenage slogan. It was a business model. And I'm not excusing my failure here. In fact, the reason I've spent 3 years, 7 days a week as an activist is that I feel like I need to do that to make up for how incredibly stupid I was for those years. And the thing to recognize is that Facebook and Google and Amazon and Microsoft got to an amazing scale before the flaws in their business model became evident.
And why is that? Can now that with the benefit of hindsight, tell us what were those signals that you didn't put together and overlooked, and how did it keep happening over and over again?
Well, to be clear, the things the first signal that I saw was a thing called Beacon, which was the first advertising product that tried to integrate Facebook with the real world. And it essentially worked like this. If you bought something from a Beacon retailer, your purchase would show up in your Facebook newsfeed. And it was famous because there was no preparation of the user base for this at all. It just started one day. And famously, a young man here in the Bay Area bought an engagement ring from Overstock.com at like 90% off. And his bride-to-be learned about the fact that he was going to propose because she saw this in his feed. All his friends saw it. And it wasn't just, you know, Mr. X has bought a diamond engagement ring. He bought it at 90% off for this price, and here's a picture of it. And that was, as you can imagine, catastrophic. And in my mind, Beacon was such a horrific failure. It was such a terrible idea to begin with, and it was so poorly executed that normal human beings would have gone, well, I'm not going anywhere near that again. It's literally like putting your hands on a hot stove. And what I didn't realize was that they didn't learn that way, that the lesson they took out of Beacon was that they pushed a little too hard, but the basic idea was right, that integrating offline and online was going to be really important to advertising. Another signal that was out there related to the development, you may recall Zynga, which had Farmville and the, I think it was Party Poker. Zynga essentially figured out how to get access to Facebook friends lists. And they did this at a time when the average user, I think, was using Facebook a minute and a half a day. And Facebook was totally focused on growing its user count. But if it was going to sell ads, it needed people to spend more time. Because it's a media company. They're competing against all these other media, and they need more attention for the ads to be valuable. And users of Zynga were on there like an hour a day playing poker or playing Farmville. And that's the light bulb goes off, and Facebook begins the program of giving applications on the Facebook platform access to friends lists, the thing that led to Cambridge Analytica. And there was a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission over this in 2011. They come down like a hammer. And my assumption was, well, hey, of course they're going to comply with the consent decree. I mean, the consequences of not doing so are very severe. Literally, it's like $40,000 per offense on Cambridge Analytica alone. If you did it at full value, it'd be like $1 trillion. And, you know, so of course they're going to apply. It never occurred to me that they would do what they did, which was to pretend like it had never happened. And so what I've learned since is that Google and then Facebook and now Microsoft and Amazon are not afraid to use deception. That this business model that they use, which Google perfected, is one that the Harvard professor Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. And in surveillance capitalism, you're essentially applying the notions of the Harvard scholar B.F. Skinner, which, you know, he was really in, he's the inventor of operant conditioning. And one of the core elements of his behavioral psychology was that the subject cannot be aware of the experiment. So it turns out that subterfuge and misdirection were central to the models of these companies. And I was completely unaware of it. And as far as I know, essentially all the other investors were unaware of it as well. I mean, I was part of Kleiner Perkins. Our integral fund was part of Kleiner Perkins at the time they made the investment in Google. And I'm quite certain that these concepts never once came up in a conversation that I was part of. I think they went out of their way to pretend like they were doing something different. The same way a magician wants you to focus on the left hand so you don't see that the right hand has done something very clever that's setting up the next trick. And, you know, at the end of the day, these companies don't operate in a vacuum. We live at a time where the banking industry destroyed the economy without consequences. Where Wells Fargo took money from millions of account holders. Nobody went to jail. Where ExxonMobil conducted its own foreign policy in Russia in contravention of sanctions. And Rex Tillerson was made the Secretary of State. I mean, we have a massive failure of markets, and we have a massive failure of the interplay of business and government. Government is no longer allowed to set the rules for business. It's no longer allowed to enforce the rules. That businesses just have free rein. And in this environment, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft come along. They're very smart people. They see what everybody else is doing, and they go for it. It's like Oklahoma, right? I mean, they just...
They would be stupid not to?
Well, I don't know if they'd be stupid not to. I'm just saying that they would be operating on a different set of values and different set of rules. That, you know, essentially, we've forgotten that businesses have five stakeholders. They have shareholders. They have employees. They have the communities where employees live. They have suppliers and they have customers. And we pretend as the only one of those stakeholders that matters is a shareholder. And the result is jobs get lost. Divisions get shipped overseas, right? And communities get broken. Suppliers get screwed. The same thing happens to customers. And all that seems completely normal. And all you have to do is watch the stock price of Google or Facebook or Amazon or Microsoft to appreciate that in a market economy, for the most part, the participants are very comfortable with this.
So when it comes to talking about how do you to get a handle on this, you have to think about, well, who's responsible and who ultimately needs to be held accountable for this. You could talk about it could be the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. You could talk about the government that is sort of turning a blind eye to corporations.
Well, it's also all of us. It's also all of us. I mean, you know, you and I are of a certain age. Our parents' generation fought the Second World War. You know, the older ones went through the Depression. They were active citizens, but they came back from the Second World War very tired. We've set up a consumer economy. We told people you can have it your way. And from 1950 to 2000, we focused on, in the product world, of giving people convenience, giving people exactly what they wanted, and telling them, you don't need to get involved, right? We hid hard facts from people. We weren't honest about the Warren Commission on the Kennedy assassination. Johnson did not tell the American people that Nixon had spoiled the peace talks in Vietnam. You know, we let Reagan get away with Iran-Contra. You know, we allowed the Bush administration to lie us into the Iraq War. You know, we let the Obama administration get away with not punishing Bush for torture, you know, and not punishing the banks for killing the economy. I mean, we've just lost the ability to have accountability. Now, I don't think that's permanent. I think those are choices because, you know, the world was framed a certain way and there was a lot of momentum. But I see change happening all around me. You know, I see Black Lives Matter coming out of Ferguson. I see the kids coming out of Parkland. I believe there were 60 labor actions by teachers last year that were successful, which is like wildly more than been for years. Stop and Shop had a successful labor action in a corporation, which was the first one I can remember in ages. The air traffic controllers ended the government shutdown. In San Juan, what did they get? Like a million people out in the streets and got rid of the governor. I mean, look at the people of Hong Kong. They got 3/4 of the population of Hong Kong in the streets protesting. I mean, you can see where this should go. We need to get engaged. We all need to recognize that what's going on in Silicon Valley, what's going on the internet, is simply a bright, glaring example of what is essentially a pervasive problem in society.
But your thought that it's really up to consumers to rise up, as it were, the end users, suggests that there's a level playing field here. And you said yourself that there's a lot that's been hidden from people. So how will they know that they've been duped or zucked or whatever verb you want to use?
So what I'm saying is the reason we need to get engaged is because policymakers in Washington, policymakers in Sacramento understand that this is not business as usual. This requires their intervention. But they can only go so far without a lot of public support. This is where we get involved. We have a presidential election coming in 2020, and this should be front and center. Why? Because it is the nature of internet platforms that their business model is enhanced by hate speech, by disinformation, by conspiracy theories. Not because they like it, but because there is this element of human psychology that is really basic in our evolutionary development about flight or fight, and that we react more to hate speech, disinformation, and conspiracy theories because they trigger flight or fight. And the algorithms, in order to keep us engaged, are going to give us the stuff that get us to spend more time to share more. And that is hate speech, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. And if you look at that, that means climate change denial, anti-vax, white supremacy, all of the extremist material that's producing so much gun violence. Those things are all enabled by these platforms. There are so many of the social ills of the country that have been taken from a bad but manageable level to the currently outrageous levels that we're experiencing because of these platforms. And so my plea to everyone is to make this a front and center issue in 2020, to make this a litmus test.
And what exactly do you want people to make
front
and center here?
I think there are two pieces, okay? And the core one is to go to every politician you can find and ask the following question. Why is it legal for corporations to collect, transfer, and exploit my most personal data? Why are banks allowed to sell financial data? Why are credit card processors allowed to sell my credit card stream? Why are cellular companies allowed to sell my location? Why are healthcare data companies allowed to sell my most intimate health information? Why are online companies allowed to track me? Why are companies that sell email services or online productivity applications or texting, so specifically Google and Microsoft, allowed to scan my private messages for their economic benefit? Is any of that legal? It shouldn't be. Those are the underpinnings of surveillance capitalism. And it would be illegal if you were at a phone company to listen to a call or to open a letter at the Postal Service. Why is it okay for Microsoft and Google to read your emails or your documents? I mean, that's crazy. And why is surveillance legitimate? Why is it okay for Amazon to put Alexas in our home and then keep the audio? I mean, why are they allowed to use it for their purposes? Why shouldn't all data be used in what I would characterize as a first-party intended use? I can give my location to Uber so that they can send transportation to take me somewhere. But they cannot transfer that data to anybody else. And they can't use it for anything but providing me with that ride.
But how would they turn a profit without that
that
model?
That is their problem, okay? They're not allowed to destroy your life or anybody else's life for their gain. Let me give you an example. Companies like Google and Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft have data voodoo dolls on each and every one of us. The data we put into the system is a tiny fraction, less than 1% of what they have. Most of it they get by buying it from banks, credit card processors, healthcare companies, tracking us online, reading our emails and all that. With that data voodoo doll, they can make incredibly accurate forecasts because they've looked at life events and they look at the 1,000 steps people take before a life event, buying a car, getting pregnant, whatever. And then they compare each new person against that thing and they can make a prediction of future behavior, which means that Google knows with roughly 90% confidence that a woman is pregnant before she does. And you say to yourself, well, what's wrong with them selling that to Pampers? I go, maybe nothing. But what's wrong with them selling it to somebody who wants to bomb you with anti-vax propaganda? I consider that deeply evil. And what's wrong here is we're losing control of our choices because these guys are making, not only are they selling behavioral predictions about what we're going to do, they control our most important sources of information. and they use that same data voodoo doll to massage our search results and our news feed to make those predictions come true. Now, my point here is the way you stop that is you just say, I'm sorry, you can't use data voodoo dolls anymore, and nobody can trade private data. And, you know, the alternative would be you could tax micro-targeted advertising very highly. But it's better to end the practice, and then we can have a reasonable conversation about what is okay and what's not okay. But as for Uber and all the other people who are the bad actors in this scenario, this is their problem. They need to have business models that are honest and don't harm people. And I believe that the service Uber offers is incredibly valuable. And I believe that people will pay enough to make it valid. But that's a test they're going to have to run. They shouldn't be able to do harm while they're doing this. I just don't think they're entitled to do that. I don't think any corporation is entitled to harm democracy or public health or privacy. I just think those things are, that's called liberty. And those are really basic American values.
And that's a great notion. The question is how we get there. We'll unwrap that a little bit more as the hour unfolds. But first, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we are discussing the dark side of social media with Silicon Valley investor or former investor. I don't know. Are you still investing?
No.
Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, tweet us, or post a comment on our Facebook page.
So, Joseph, the other thing that we should be doing, which Congress is actually doing, is creating alternatives. One of the real problems is that the big four, so Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, have massive monopoly power. And they have control of the audience. So any new startup needs to go through them to reach an audience. That has to stop. And antitrust law is the way to do that. And fortunately, Congress has begun to spin up on it. And the European Union is spinning up on it. And this is very, very important. Because I believe that there is an alternative to surveillance capitalism that is much more attractive. That essentially, when you have monopoly, you stifle innovation. You wind up getting less new fun stuff than you would get. And you can see this in the number of startups. You can see this in all this data. And I believe that if we could return Silicon Valley and the technology industry to the notion of empowering users again, get back to Steve Jobs' idea of bicycles for the mind, technology that's both healthy and fun, that model, I believe, will be wildly more valuable. And it might not produce four companies value between half $1 trillion, $1 trillion, but it might produce thousands of companies worth $1 billion, and that would be an inherently better, more American model. And we've gone through this before. We went through it with AT&T in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We went through it with the robber barons in 1900 to 1918. And it's time to go back and do that again, to reclaim the country from the four corporations that are basically taking control of our lives.
I want to go to a tweet here. And the tweet is, we are Zucked, but we don't have to stay that way. Facebook is best in the trash heap. Not all things broken can be repaired. And we need strong legislation with real penalties for those that profit from our stuff, namely our data. Yes, your data is your stuff. Stand up for yourselves. So what I want to zero in on that comment is Facebook fatally broken, and does it need to be thrown into the trash heap, as our listener suggests?
I would like to believe that Mark Zuckerberg can still be the hero of his own story. That I'd like him to have an epiphany, to have a good night's sleep and wake up in the morning and realize that he can do more good for the world by reforming the business model of Facebook than he can with 1,000 Chan Zuckerberg initiatives. And I hold out hope. I think realistically, the person who tweeted that is got some validity to the argument that it may be very hard to fix these things. And realistically, as a user, the thing we should understand, the problem is not the technology. There's nothing wrong with social media. The issue is surveillance capitalism. It's the business model. It's the culture. It's the business practices. And we can get all the things we like with those horrible aspects. We just have to insist on it. And we have to be willing to temporarily accept a little bit less convenience in our lives in order to make that happen. We have to value liberty. We have to value our own health, our children's mental health. We have to value democracy enough to say, you know what? I'm going to temporarily give up the benefit of having all my Google products interconnected and having them know everything about me, because it turns out that the cost of that is incredibly high.
So literally, how do you monetize this technology if it's not going to be monetized the way it's currently functioning, which is basically getting your attention to on the page long enough so that you can be bombarded by ads that'll affect your buying habits and so on?
Well, hang on. To be clear, the issue isn't advertising either. It's micro-targeted advertising backed by a data voodoo doll that allows you to manipulate what people know. The old broadcast model of advertising was, relatively speaking, harmless in comparison. The issue here is the highly manipulative nature of surveillance capitalism, the deception and the essentially constraining choices that are given to people. If we all approached Google, Facebook, and Amazon and Microsoft as though they were a game, that they were fiction, that nothing on there was real, and it was really a form of entertainment only, a lot of the harm would go down. Where we really get into trouble is that people believe these things reflect reality. And they don't. They are, you know, they're like a hall of mirrors in a carnival sideshow, that everything's distorted. Everything is phony. It's artificial. You see all these young kids whose career goal is to be an influencer. I mean, that's insane. That's like kids in high school all thinking they're going to be in the NBA. I mean, it just... That kind of stuff is not healthy, right? You know, some people are going to be influencers. Some people are going to be in the NBA, but that's not going to apply to enough people for everybody to make that their career goal. And, you know, most of us are suited better to something else. And it's okay to be different. And part of what's going on, I think, in society is that we've forgotten the notion of... You know, we've forgotten our humanity, right? We don't look each other in the eye anymore. We don't, you know, people have relationships via texting, right? And they're so mean to each other. And you sit there and you think to yourself, wow, if they were only in the same room, they'd be a lot nicer.
But back to the question, though, what would an alternative business model look like?
Well, I'm saying you can have advertising that's just not micro-targeted. You can have subscriptions. There are lots of ways to do this. That issue, in my opinion, these things are demonstrably...
People actually have to pay to use, which they don't do in a very obvious way right now.
No,
right?
But what they're actually paying is wildly above what the cost would be if you paid explicitly. They just don't recognize that the fact that they're miserable all the time, the fact that their kid is suicidal, that the fact that their democracy has produced the situation we have in Washington right now, are all direct results of these products. The fact that there was what the UN called a classic ethnic cleansing in Myanmar. The fact that you have 51 people dead in Christchurch, you have 22 dead in El Paso. These things are all directly related to these platforms, and all of that is because of surveillance technology and the micro-targeting. And excuse me, we just need to be aware that that's going on. And if we are, then we can look at these things and realize, wait a minute. You know, it's a simulation. It's a video game. Don't take any of it seriously, right? Have a real life and then play this on the side. Don't let this be your life.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And I'm talking this evening with Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Again, the number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And to your last point, let's bring Neil from San Francisco on the air. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I agree very much in broad strokes with what you and your guests are talking about. I guess one comment and maybe follow-up is to talk about amplification on these social media platforms rather than the creation of what I'll call problematic tendencies. And one area that I've heard your guests talk about it is there seems to be a bit of a discussion about these platforms promoting problematic areas on the quote-unquote right, and I invite guests to think about it as being inviting amplification of extremist views, left and right, rather than just putting it on the, you know, the left-right spectrum. So that's one comment. And with that amplification, rather than the creation of these problems on the media, and an NPR program last week had a very good discussion about a lot of the, for example, propensities of racism in our government have been around for a long time, but have now been amplified by things like the dark web and social media, rather than them being created by these. So that's just sort of one overriding topic. It relates to, I guess, also your guest seems to have a lot of prescriptions for what we should do, and I'd suggest that maybe it's more an opening up of discussions about what we could do rather than specific prescriptions that are suggested, like the first user-only use of the data. So I'll take further comments after that.
Yeah, so, Neil, first of all, I completely agree with you about amplification. You know, a lot of the conversations recently have been about, you know, the role of corporations in policing freedom of speech and corporate censorship. And I'm totally hostile to that. I do not believe corporations should be censoring. In my mind, the issue is one that my colleague Rene DiResta characterizes as freedom of reach as opposed to freedom of speech, where the issue here is that the algorithms are designed to maximize engagement. And that means that they amplify the signals of the things that people react to most, and the largest number of people react to outrage and fear. And so that's why hate speech and disinformation and conspiracy theories are promoted so heavily. And there is currently no negative consequence for that business practice of promoting the most harmful content that's out there, which has essentially allowed things like climate change denial, like anti-vax, like flat earth, like white supremacy, to gain levels of exposure in our national dialogue that would never have been possible without these things.
This so-called democratization, which then gave things, you know, more an inflated impact than they would have otherwise had.
And I want to also say to Neil, I either misspoke or was misunderstood with respect to the issues of left and right. You know, the reality is that you're completely correct that these things will amplify extreme things on both sides. What happened in the world is that the business of publishing in media fear and outrage was already a big business before these platforms came along. That things like Fox had built a great business out of making people fearful. And so that on the right, there was a larger existing market for fear and outrage than there was on the left. And I do not think that's necessarily structural, but it is what it is. And the result of this is that right-wing perspectives have gotten much more advantage politically from these platforms. And I'm not making a judgment about the validity of the political point of view. I'm simply talking about the facts. If you sit there and look at it, we have not seen the rise of left-wing groups globally over the last 10 years. You've seen a massive explosion of right-wing groups, and with highly coordinated, you know, across countries. And
that was a pre-existing condition, so to speak.
Exactly. And so when you're looking at this stuff, my basic point, and to the third point that you made relative to my prescriptions, I was responding to Joseph on that because he's pushing me on that. But I am very much in your camp, Neil, on wanting to have conversations. What I always say to people is, you know, I'm not asking you to believe me. I'm asking you to just imagine what would happen if I were right. Just run a thought experiment. Can you imagine, you know, what the alternative universe would be if we returned Silicon Valley and all of technology to focusing on empowering people again instead of essentially treating them as fuel? That, you know, they're not taking your data to help you. They're taking your data to improve the models that they use to predict whether somebody's pregnant or whether they're going to buy a car. And you're not getting much benefit from that, and you may well be harmed by it, because if you're in the wrong mosque in Christchurch, the wrong synagogue in Pittsburgh, or the wrong Walmart in El Paso, you didn't have to be on social media to be dead. You just needed to be in a place where somebody who was affected by this stuff carried out their hate.
Let's go to an email from Peter. What if a large population is hooked on the pleasure and security of the surveillance economy? Has fear pushed us here?
That's such a great question. Yeah, so here's the thing. My goal, and this really comes to Neil's point also, that my goal is to make sure we have a conversation about this. I can imagine a scenario where everybody understood what Google's smart city strategy was, which almost they're doing it in Toronto right now. And the almost inevitable consequence of it is that you're going to substitute algorithmic processes for democracy, or what Facebook's strategy is with Libra, which is a cryptocurrency designed to replace reserve currencies like the dollar and the yen. And everybody could look at that and say, you know what? I'm tired of democratic government. I'd much rather have very clever Silicon Valley people run it. As long as we had a thoughtful democratic process to determine that outcome, I guess I would at least acknowledge that that was the answer. My problem here is that the vast majority of people have only a partial understanding of what's going on, and therefore they're not getting a chance to be part of their own future. And as long as everybody has full information, they're free to make whatever choice they want.
How do these platforms lead to addiction, asks Kathy. What is the
great
impact
question
on our mental health?
Oh, such a great question, Kathy. So here's what the problem is. If you're Facebook, you're Google, and you're the advertising portion of Microsoft or Amazon, you really are a media company. You can tell the whole world you're a platform, not a media company, because that provides you with legal cover. But you're competing for advertising dollars against everything from newspapers, magazines, television. You're competing for time against video games and Netflix and everything else. You need to get people on board. So it starts with a really simple advantage. These things are mostly on smartphones, which are on your body all the time. They know who you are. They can target you exactly. And so what do? They appeal to elements of human psychology we can't avoid, our need for rewards. They do that with notifications. Hey, 37 people liked your post, or please join my network on LinkedIn, or you've been tagged in a photograph. And that starts a cycle. The first thing is social validation. Wow, somebody liked my post, or they've asked me to join their network. Well, if they asked me to join their network, I should reciprocate. So that triggers the need for social reciprocity. When you have a thing on your body, their goal is to get you to check it every idle moment. And, you know, we think to ourselves, well, okay, so that's just a habit. The problem is for many of us, in fact, I'd argue most of us, the habit becomes an addiction. And the definition of addiction is that you do it even though you know it's harmful. And this is people checking their phones while they're driving, right? Which is, shall we say, I think all too common. And that's the first step. They get you hooked. Now they have to keep you on board. How do they do that? They do that with a different set of tricks. And essentially, you know, they do it with a never-ending news feed, with autoplay, things that keep you on the site. They do it with Facebook groups. They do it with the constant reinforcement of the things that you've reacted to previously. And they essentially, over time, create a filter bubble, which is this hermetically sealed environment where everything that you see confirms your previous biases. And in the end, we all wind up...
It's an amazing self-esteem booster, basically, is what you're saying.
Well, it can be, or it can be completely devastating, right? Because it depends on your peer group. But at the end of the day, we're each in our own Truman Show. And if you think about this from a perspective of democracy, We have 40% of the population that is absolutely convinced of at least one thing that is demonstrably false, whether it's climate change, anti-vax, flat earth, whatever. You add all those things up, it's about 40% of the population. How do you have a democracy if you can't agree on the facts? I mean, it's okay to disagree about what to do about climate change, but you have to acknowledge that it's real. I mean, all the science is there. And people say to me, Roger, how do I know if I'm addicted? I go, here's the test. When do you check your phone? First thing in the morning. Is it before you pee or while you're peeing? Because pretty much that's the range, right? The vast majority of us check the phone in the first 15 minutes we're awake. And we're all hooked. And it's just how it is. So armed with that information, we can protect ourselves. But we have to acknowledge, you know, the first step in any addiction is acknowledging that you're addicted.
So Christy writes, what should we be doing about social media and our kids? What should our schools be recommending to keep our kids safe?
Can I just say to the listeners, you guys are asking fantastic questions. So, Christy, in the book I talk about kids. I'm not a parent, so I went and talked to a lot of pediatricians and educators about this. I'm deeply troubled by the experiment we ran on children starting about 20 years ago where we exposed them to technology from birth and gave them more and more and more of it. And it turns out that constant exposure to screens, whether it's a smartphone, a tablet, or a computer, stimulates dopamine in children to excessive levels, and it affects their ability to concentrate. When kids are in elementary school, particularly grades 1 through 5 or so, they're supposed to be learning to concentrate on the teacher. They're supposed to be learning to socialize with their classmates, and having a screen on their desk interferes with that. Now, if a kid's a special needs kid, that's a different thing. But for most kids, having a screen in the classroom is a bad idea. I think in general, pediatricians have concluded now that less exposure and later is better, always. So whatever, you know, you think is the right number, less than that is probably a better number.
And older than that.
And older than that. And here's the thing. Kids are highly adaptable, right? So I'm sure that they're going to find some way to get through this. But learning to concentrate. I mean, I've read estimates, right, that we're within a few years of kids not being able to read a 100-page book because it's like emotionally painful to them. And I'm going, that would be a tragedy if that were true, right? And I don't want to keep us stuck in an old world. I really believe that technology can empower us. I just think that the business models that Google and Facebook have right now are doing a lot of harm. And texting for preteens and teenagers and Instagram for preteens and teenagers is, you know, the data is coming in, but it looks like there's a really high degree of correlation between those products and bullying, those products and the increase in teen suicide and the massive increase in teen stress. And it's a big burden. So I think making sure that kids have permission not to have technology early, so play groups that are built around things that are not, you know, tech-related, and organizing parent groups, you know, like a book club, where you just say, look, we're going to have device-free days to start, and then there'll be more device-free days, and we're going to make that time really high quality and fun. Because eventually a generation of kids should come along that look at this and go, oh, my God, those older kids, they're so uncool. They're just in their screens all the time. Mm-hmm. And they're going to rebel against that the same way my generation, you know, went with rock and roll to rebel against, you know, what our parents liked. And that can't come soon enough for me. But, you know, I do. The book does have several things, and I've also recommended some books in there. There's a one called Glow Kids by Nicholas Carteris. And Adam Alter is a professor at NYU, has a fantastic book, the name of which escapes me at the moment, but which I recommend in my in my bibliography.
Let's go to a caller, Harry from San Francisco. Harry, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes, good evening. I have the impression your guest believes that Hillary Clinton is not president and Donald Trump is president because of Facebook, or that Facebook had a major role to play that. And can he please explain that view if he actually holds it?
So,
thank you.
Yeah. So, Harry, I am not in the business of relitigating 2016. What I am in the business of being is an analyst with respect to what happened. And the election of President Trump was the result of the confluence of a whole bunch of different factors. One of the last factors, well, one of the early factors, of course, were the Russian hacks of the Democratic National Committee and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the theft of a lot of campaign materials that would have been super helpful in competing against Democrats across the board. And there, it's also true that Stephen Bannon, who advised President Trump, was the founder of Cambridge Analytica, and he absolutely had a much better idea than anybody around Clinton for how to use technology in an election setting. And they did so in a way that clearly was not inside the Trump campaign, was clearly not proscribed by the law, right? They, you know, there was nothing that says you can't do voter suppression using internet platforms. And they did targeted voter suppression that was unbelievably effective. And it, you know, it was one of many things that influenced the outcome of the election. And, you know, they had that insight and the Democrats did not. And in my mind, I think that there was something about these platforms in 2016 that created that outcome, that you just sit there and go, look, that's history. We're not worried about that. I think what we're supposed to be worried about is having fair elections going forward where every vote counts and where the voters determine the outcome. And so, so Harry, it, you know, what I think about 2016 is that it's ancient history. I'm totally focused on 2020, on 2022, 2024, and making sure that internet platforms are not available for China, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, you know, Russia, et cetera, to interfere with from the outside, and not available for domestic candidates and corporations to mess with from the inside. I mean, climate change denial is what it is because of really sophisticated campaigns run on social media. A big part of the NRA's success is doing the same thing. A huge part of all of anti-vax is from that. And I'm just looking at this and going, that's not a good way to run a public square.
A question on my mind, and also an email from David. Does Roger still have Mark Zuckerberg's ear, and how has Facebook responded to your book?
I only wish. No, I have not had a conversation with Mark in a long time. And the last time I corresponded with him was on the 30th of October of 2016 when I sent him the op-ed. And Mark got right back to me very politely, but also in a way that was kind of dismissive because I think that he probably looked at me and said, Roger, if you're so smart, where are your 2 billion users, right? No, Mark has not engaged with no one at Facebook has had a conversation with me since February 2017. I spent 3 months privately trying to persuade them to do what Johnson & Johnson did after that guy put poison in bottles of Tylenol in Chicago, which is, you know, Johnson & Johnson basically didn't wait for somebody to tell them. They just did everything possible to protect their customers. They took every bottle off the shelf. They invented tamper-proof packaging, you know. I was convinced that Facebook could turn whatever was happening in 2016 in Brexit with Black Lives Matter, with the housing and urban development and the Russians into a positive by, you know, engaging directly. They chose not to do that, and no one at Facebook has been willing to speak to me since.
So going back to the points you made earlier in the hour about how you thought Facebook would have responded to the slaps on the wrists it's received in the past, and it just kept going. The most recent slap on the wrist, or at least one of them, is from the Federal Trade Commission, a $5 billion fine, you know, the requirement of a privacy committee, but immunity for Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg.
And for the company for everything else. And to be clear, if the Federal Trade Commission had chosen to go to the max, they could have levied a fine literally of $1 trillion or more, you know, more than the market value of Facebook. The $5 billion fine with the blanket immunity that came with it was a bargain, which is why investors marked the stock up immediately. They really liked that outcome. And it was a gift. Now, it was a record fine. It was better than doing nothing at all, by a lot. But it's not going to change the incentives for Facebook any more than the Federal Trade Commission consent decree did in 2011. And, you know, I do see Facebook making changes. There was a report just out in the last couple of days that they abandoned a merger, an acquisition they were going to do because they were afraid of antitrust scrutiny. They're trying to smash together Instagram and WhatsApp with Facebook to try to keep the FTC, to keep antitrust from breaking them up. Those are not the right answers here. The right answers here is very simple. Stop hurting people. Stop undermining democracy.
And what's going to make them do that?
Well, like I say, the government has to be prepared to do what the government of Sri Lanka did when they had an act of terrorism and Facebook ignored them. They just shut down all the platforms for a week or two. And I think that until the platforms recognize that governments actually do have some power over them, nothing's going to happen. Now, I think you can get there by degrees, you know, with more fines and more regulations and all that. These guys all live here, so the U.S. government has some power. The state of California has huge power here. And I'm, you know, Javier Becerra, our state attorney general, is, you know, he is a true leader on this, and I'm really optimistic that Governor Newsom will be a leader on this. And, you know, we have the best privacy law in the country, but it's just a bare minimum. And the industry has been very successful at preventing any kind of enforcement from being added to that. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to insist, and that's going to require all of us. We're going to have to be willing to change our behavior at least a little bit. If we insist on playing into the hands of these guys, then that's going to be the answer.
I want to get one more call in before we end. George from San Francisco, welcome to the program.
If you have your, if you've ear to the ground, you must be coming up with an occasional read that says the natives are restless, and normally in an activity with so much commerce, people call strikes periodically. Do you see something like that on the horizon, or is it already here?
Yeah, George, that's a great question. When I was talking earlier about the Parkland kids on gun violence, or the teachers that have been doing their strikes around the country, or Stop and Shop, we're seeing levels of civic engagement by Americans that we haven't seen in a generation. And I'm really hopeful in that regard. And I hope every listener will go, you know, whether they have kids in school or whether they have book clubs or friends, to just talk about this stuff and figure out what can we do together. You know, the best part of my book tour, Joseph, has been face-to-face contact with people I hadn't seen in 30 years and then meeting literally tens of thousands of new people. And my life was mediated by technology as bad as any human being on earth. I still carry two smartphones. There was a time I had seven devices on my belt. I mean, I looked like Batman. And I mean, it was pitiful. And I'd allowed technology to mediate my whole life. And I was missing the richness of human interaction. And this is what I mean when I say Facebook and Instagram and Google are, they're simulations. They're not real life. Real life is you and I looking each other in the eye across this table. It's me talking to George over this line and recognizing that George is, he's a person with a really good question. And George, when you're ready to go out in the street, you call me, okay? Because, you know, we do have to be willing to do it. 3 years ago, I decided to make up for my long involvement in this company by essentially going out in the street. I've spent 3 years, 7 days a week. Now, that's interesting because I was only an insider at the company for about 3 years. So I've now got about equal levels of thing. And I'm not having as much impact now, but I sure hope to have it before I'm done.
Well, I want to thank you, Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, for joining me and for sharing your insights tonight.
This has been really fun. I want to thank the listeners for the great questions.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David Latulippe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday when we look at the mounting level of student loan debt. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.